its Arab allies in the region, and indeed from President Biden's own supporters in the United States who want to see this war stop, is that in fact it's scaling down to lower intensity operations. Or more often, it doesn't say that quite outright. It says it will move away from high intensity operations into what it says is a so-called phase three of its operations in Gaza. So what is phase three? Phase three focuses on southern Gaza. Every day we are getting reports of casualties from Gaza, civilian casualties in the triple digits. Israel already made something like 1.7, 1.8 million people relocate to southern Gaza. So this war is not, in fact, scaling down. It's moving toward a sustainable path of civilian devastation.
Spencer Ackerman, foreign policy columnist for The Nation magazine, will also publishes the Forever Wars on newsletter on Ghost. We'll link to your pieces at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for the KBOO Evening News comes from KBOO members and Lori Sonnenfeld Realty, helping people buy or sell a home or duplex in the greater Portland area for the past 35 years. More information at CascadiaHomes.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, updates on the historic winter freeze. No word tonight on when the Banfield Freeway will reopen. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson has asked a judge to block the merger between supermarket giants Albertsons and Kroger. And a new bipartisan expansion of the child tax credit has emerged, giving children's advocates hope that some households will get another economic lifeline. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 17th, 2024. I'm Josh Salem. As the Portland metro area begins to thaw from the weekend's Arctic blast and Tuesday's ice storm, the true toll is just beginning to be counted. KBOO's Zoe Carina has more.
Following a weekend of winter weather, and with freezing rain today, at least 8 people have died in the Portland area. The Multnomah County Medical Examiner suspects 4 men died of hypothermia, but an autopsy will be needed to see if something else played a part in their deaths. In Lake Oswego, winds knocked down more than 100 trees, 30 of them falling right onto homes and killing one person. One person in Northeast Portland died when a tree fell on an RV and set it aflame. 3 others in the RV escaped. Yesterday, around 50,000 people across the state, including 21,000 in the metro area, were still without electricity. Today's warmer weather is expected to bring airport traffic back to normal, with schools and government offices opening tomorrow.
That was KBOO's Zoe Carina. For the first time in 5 days, temperatures climbed above the freezing mark, and the icy Arctic blast that has hammered Portland in the Pacific Northwest since Saturday is finally moving out. But not before coating the metropolitan area with up to a half inch of ice. The frozen conditions made ground travel treacherous in many areas and caused multiple delays and cancellations among TriMet's bus and train routes. The Portland Bureau of Transportation reported that most major roadways have a single lane clear, but that many side streets are totally iced over. Portland International Airport reported that many flights were canceled or delayed, and it urged travelers to check the website flypdx.com before heading to the airport. As of this morning, more than 14,000 PGE customers were without power across the Tri-County area. The utility reported that this is down from the 31,000 who were without power yesterday, and the crews were working around the clock to restore power as quickly as possible. Due to the extreme cold, Multnomah County opened a record 12 warming shelters in Portland and Gresham, and officials noted that more than 1,800 people sought shelter on Monday night. In more weather news, road crews worked all day to open I-84 from milepost 17 to 64, but as of Wednesday afternoon, the Oregon Department of Transportation declined to post an estimated time for the reopening. The freeway's been closed since Tuesday afternoon, when the first big ice storm of the year hit. State officials say they don't expect the Banfield to reopen until Thursday, when it's hoped the ice storm will ease in the gorge. Residents in part of the affluent town of West Lynn were advised to boil their water yesterday because of a weather-related equipment failure that threatened their municipal supply. Freezing temperatures led to a potential loss of water pressure in West Lynn's Horton Water Pressure Zone. The city issued the boil water notice as a precaution against waterborne disease. Officials said today that the pressure has been restored and the water system has been flushed. The dust settles on the Iowa caucuses. And House Rules Committee pauses holding Hunter Biden in contempt of Congress. With these stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If you look at what's happening in the country, it's not good. And you don't have to turn on the news to see it. You feel it when you go to the gas station. You feel it when you go to the grocery store. We feel it in our mortgage payments. We feel it in our insurance payments. Everything that we have to pay has gone up.
Now that the dust and snow have settled in Iowa, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, former President Donald Trump, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis are moving on to New Hampshire. Speaking at a rally in Bretton Woods, Haley called for cuts in government spending, blaming President Joe Biden, but also congressional Republicans, citing billions in pandemic-era funds. Trump got a bit more than half the caucus votes, with DeSantis getting about 20% and Haley close behind that. Despite saying he'd stay through Super Tuesday, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson has suspended his campaign after placing sixth. Vivek Ramaswamy is doing so as well, and he's endorsing Trump.
Every one of us in this room has done our part to save this country, and I am so proud of every one of you who have lifted us up. But we're a campaign founded on the truth, and so that's why we've made that decision today. And I'm also making the decision that this has to be an America First candidate in that White House.
Trump and Haley have begun attacking each other more directly in the Granite State. ABC canceled a debate after Haley demanded Trump take part, and the former president refused. Biden is calling congressional leaders to the White House to discuss his $110 billion foreign aid package, another sign that some kind of deal on Ukraine support and new immigration policies may be in the works. The House Rules Committee is suspending its push to hold Hunter Biden in contempt of Congress as his lawyers negotiate ground rules for his testimony. Alabama aims to help police deal with the 10% of people in the state who have sensory issues, which law enforcement might not recognize right away. Montgomery Police Chief Daryl Albert says a new state law requires police to undergo training to help better understand what can trigger someone.
We're going to look at some of the outlying things like flashing lights when they come up on the scene. That can trigger an individual with sensory needs. Your loud sirens, a lot of officers crowding the person can cause problems. So we got to be able to recognize those things and adapt accordingly. And that's what this training is going to be focused on.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In the 2019 case, Martin v. Boise, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that it's, quote, cruel and unusual punishment to criminalize camping on public property when the people in question have nowhere else that they can legally sleep, end quote. Later that year, the Supreme Court denied a petition by the city of Boise to review the case, leaving the prior ruling in place. In a subsequent case, Johnson v. Grants Pass, the court ruled that cities cannot criminalize using tents or cars for sleeping unless the government offers other options. But on Friday, after an appeal by the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that could dramatically impact how cities respond to houselessness. And, regardless of how they rule, the impact will be felt nationally. City and state governments have repeatedly requested a review, stating that the two Ninth Circuit rulings have restricted their ability to enforce camping ordinances, keep sidewalks clear, and ensure public safety. Mayor London Breed of San Francisco has been particularly blunt. Breed said, quote, "The fact that the courts have crippled our ability to do our job to help get people into shelter is criminal. If we have a place for someone to go, they need to go. There needs to be accountability," end quote. Houseless advocates have said the public camping bans are merely an attempt to criminalize houselessness, and that cities would be better served putting their efforts towards more affordable housing. A Supreme Court decision is expected in June. Toxic pollution was dumped along the Columbia River at a named Superfund site, but cleanup of the area is progressing slowly. The pollution has affected fish near the site. KBOO's Zoe Carina has the details.
Advocates are making slow but steady progress to clean up a portion of the Columbia River that has been named an EPA Superfund site. Toxic pollution dumped by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the past 40 years at Bradford Island contaminated fish in the area. These fish are used as sustenance by the region's indigenous peoples. Rose Longoria is Regional Superfund Project Manager for the Yakima Nation. She says that the contaminated site has been known for about 2 decades, but only recently got Superfund listing.
If it wasn't for Yakima Nation, Bradford Island would not be on the national priorities list. And even now, I believe that if it wasn't for Yakima, no one else would be pushing as hard to get this site the attention that it needs.
There is a do not eat advisory for resident fish near Bradford Island. Organizations like Columbia Riverkeeper have created advisories in English and in Spanish to let people know which fish are safe to harvest. Laura Shira is an environmental engineer with Yakima Nation Fisheries. She says resident fish near Bradford Island have the highest in the nation concentration of a toxic compound known as polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs.
There's all these fishing platforms on the Washington shoreline, on Goose Island, on the Oregon shoreline, and those are tribal fishing platforms, and they're within like a quarter to a third of a mile of what we know to be the worst contaminated area on that north shore of Bradford Island.
While it's listed as a Superfund site, Yakima Nation and others in the region are still waiting for a concrete cleanup plan. Longoria says the PCB levels in resident fish make this an emergency and thinks that the federal government should act quickly to correct the situation.
There are significant data gaps that need to be filled, but we need to do that as expeditiously as possible and determine the full nature and extent of contamination and determine the best way of cleaning up the site to protect human health and the environment.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Zoe Carina.
Major milestones in a historic effort to restore Pacific Northwest salmon habitats are quietly moving forward this month. After years of negotiation and debate between the Yurok community, PacifiCorp, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the largest dam removal project in the world is underway to restore fish habitat, improve Klamath River water quality, and give environmental policy influence back to the tribe. Last week, just over the Oregon border in Northern California, 3 dams on the Klamath River were modified with controlled drainage systems that allow water from the reservoirs behind them to slowly drain out without flooding. Officials' goal is a 5-foot water level drop per day. Last summer, the Copco 2 dam was already completely dismantled. The loss of 4 regional hydroelectric dams might seem like a lot, but PacifiCorp says it's only 2% of its energy load. Built during the first half of the 20th century, these dams were intended to generate electricity. But years of research has shown they also harm native wildlife, including wild salmon, which spawn in rivers such as the Klamath. The modern movement to remove the Klamath River Dam started about 20 years ago, when an estimated 64,000 fish died off from a bacterial infection of the water, which was blamed on warm temperatures and low water levels created by the hydroelectric dams. After years of negotiation, in 2022, PacifiCorp gave control of the dams to a nonprofit organization to manage the deconstruction and federal regulators in approving their plan to remove those dams. Deconstruction of the dams is expected to be complete in June of this year. Portland police are asking for public input as a part of their ongoing community review process. Specifically, they're asking for input on active bystandership, intervention and retaliation, and sexual assault kits and sexual assault investigations. Starting this week and running through February 15, 2024, Portland residents are encouraged to read the directives, then provide comments. All of the Bureau directives are available at www.portland.gov/police/directives. This webpage also enables community members to sign up to receive email notifications when new or revised directives are posted. Opponents want to repeal a carbon capping program in Washington State, known as the Climate Commitment Act. Defenders say that would have a cascade of effects for the state. Eric Tegetoff has the details.
Opponents of a new law that caps carbon in Washington state are waiting to see if their initiative to repeal it will appear before voters in November. Supporters say eliminating it could have a range of impacts on the state. The Climate Commitment Act was passed in 2021 and created a cap and invest program that reduces carbon from the state's largest emitters over time. In its first year of auctions in 2023, the program raised about $2 billion. The Nature Conservancy's David Mendoza says repealing the program would hit the state's transportation budget especially hard.
Inevitably, it would start affecting our ability to invest in roads and bridges that the rest of the transportation budget does, which will shrink the whole thing, and there'll be less money for everything moving forward. So they could have some really devastating effects on what we're able to do for our state if the repeal occurs.
Investments from the program have been used to create fare-free bus transit for Washingtonians age 18 and under across the state, for example. Funds have also been used for electric school buses and EV chargers. However, opponents of the Climate Commitment Act say it's raising the cost of everything in Washington, especially gas. Mendoza says the price of gas is more complicated than that. He says lawmakers should make the source of gas prices and fluctuations clear.
That's what we're trying to do, is create some transparency so the public is better aware of the whole range of things that go into setting a price of gas, and can't demonize this legislation, which has really positive effects in a whole range of other ways.
Mendoza says the state has a goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by nearly half by 2030.
The Climate Commitment Act itself accounts for 26 million metric tons of reduction. If the Climate Commitment Act goes away, there's very little ways we can actually meet that goal.
Mendoza adds the program also invests in climate resilience to defend against the effects of climate change that communities are already experiencing in the state. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article on the Supreme Court hearing an Oregon houselessness case. Then, we hear from a researcher about the latest efforts to reintroduce gray wolves in Colorado. At 6, it's Earth Riot Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Cultures in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather: showers, with lows around 37 degrees. Tomorrow's weather: rain, highs around 39 degrees. Today in history: on January 17, 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower ended his term by warning the nation about the increasing power of the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower said, "The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted." Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson has asked a judge to block the merger between supermarket giants Albertsons and Kroger. In a press conference, Ferguson said, quote, "This merger of the two largest supermarket companies in Washington will severely limit vital competition that keeps grocery prices in check," end quote. Although financial concerns have previously been raised, Monday's suit is the first legal attempt by state or federal regulators to stop Kroger's acquisition of Albertsons. In November, Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum joined an earlier Washington suit to block a massive Albertsons payout to its shareholders in anticipation of the proposed merger with Kroger. Rosenblum said the $4 billion payout would limit Albertson's cash reserves and ability to compete with Kroger during the several years that it would take to complete the merger. And in December, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden urged the Federal Trade Commission to block the merger due to the potentially negative impact on Oregon consumers. Kroger is the second largest and Albertson's the fourth largest grocery chain in the U.S. Together, the two companies control nearly 5,000 grocery stores nationwide. In addition to its own branded chain, Kroger also owns 14 others, including Fred Meyer's, QFC, and Ralph's. Albertson owns 13 branded chains, including Safeway, Vons, and Acme Markets. Cold weather is hitting communities across the U.S., not just in Oregon. A native-led church in Rapid City, South Dakota, was asked to remove a warming tent that was put up to help unsheltered residents. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As cold temperatures remain in South Dakota, Native groups in Rapid City are reaching out to their unsheltered relatives and are seeking assistance from the local government. A warming tent that was being used at the Woyaton Lutheran Church was taken down after requests from the city, which cited safety concerns. The church and Native groups are asking the city for alternatives as they continue to help those in need. They're also asking community members to drop off warming supplies, winter clothes, or volunteer their time. The cold weather is also impacting travelers. It's been a challenging week for airline travelers as the winter weather has led to several days of frustration across the Pacific Northwest and elsewhere. It's impacting plans for some tribal college students hoping to start the spring semester. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In Oregon, dozens of flights have been canceled at both the Eugene and Portland airports. Among those stuck, Tenapa Brainerd, a Coos Apache senior at the Institute of American Indian Art in Santa Fe. She's been trying to get back there since Sunday. After so many cancellations, she's resigned to staying with her family in Eugene a bit longer and seeing if her instructors will let her do classes online.
Some of them are telling me that it's going to be pretty hard. They don't do Zooms. And I'm like, well, I can't do anything about this. Can you just make an exception, please?
Brainerd says the terminal was chilly and communication was sporadic between gate staff and passengers. She kept herself entertained with Netflix movies on her phone. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Gary Fife spent more than half a century working to change the way journalists cover Indigenous peoples and was still hosting radio shows and writing a weekly column when he died Sunday at the age of 73. Fife devoted the last years of his life to his tribe in Oklahoma and the company it owns, Muskogee Media. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, he was also the first host of National Native News.
All across Oklahoma, Gary Fife was known as the voice of Muskogee, a voice well known in Indian country, in large part due to his work on National Native News, a program he helped to pioneer in Alaska in the late 1980s. Diane Kaplan, who was director of the Alaska Public Radio Network at the time, says back then it was hard to find a Native American to host a daily news show.
So I recruited Gary, and there wasn't a second person to recruit at that time that I was aware of. He was literally like the only person I could identify who had the skills to do that.
Kaplan says the pay was lousy and it fell mostly on Fife's shoulders to build a network of reporters out of a pool of mostly non-natives. In a recent interview, Fife talked about how he pushed reporters to go beyond what he called beads and feathers stories and the stereotypes they perpetuate.
Native America is like Europe. Italians are as different from the Russians as the Apaches are from the Senecas. We don't speak the same language. We don't all ride horses and chase buffalo, so we'd educate the reporters.
Gary was probably decades ahead of his time.
For Native journalists like Angel Ellis, Fife was both a journalist and a teacher.
Gary was at his core a person who loved people and their stories.
And was hopeful about the future of Native journalism.
There is a growing cadre of young Native people joining this field, and they're good. And I'm glad to be able to say that I'm seeing these changes during my lifetime.
Changes he helped to set in motion. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Iran launched airstrikes into Pakistan on Tuesday, apparently targeting a Sunni military group. The day before, Iran fired missiles at targets in Syria and Iraq, seen as reprisal for a double suicide bombing in the Iranian city of Kerman that killed more than 80 Iranians on January 3rd. The U.S. launched a third wave of strikes against the Houthis in Yemen in response to continued attacks on ships in the Red Sea. Last week, U.S. Navy SEALs boarded a boat headed for Yemen and seized Iranian-made weapons, which it claimed were bound for Houthi forces. While the Israeli assaults on Hamas in Gaza continue, A deal has been reached to allow the delivery of medicines to hostages there, as well as additional aid for civilians in the territory. It's been 2 years since Congress allowed a temporary expansion of the federal child tax credit to expire. That policy was hailed as a breakthrough in briefly helping low-income families move out of poverty. Now, a new bipartisan expansion has emerged, giving children's advocates hope that some households will get another lifeline. Mike Moen has more in South Dakota.
Congress is poised to consider renewing the expanded child tax credit. Policy analysts say the latest effort could help tens of thousands of South Dakota children. This week, congressional leaders announced a bipartisan tax deal that includes a 3-year extension of an enhanced child tax credit to make it more accessible to low-income households that typically don't qualify. It isn't as big of a credit as the temporary expansion that ended in 2021, but Zanna Berg, who leads KidCount data efforts for South Dakota, says researchers found the initial credit led to spending on basic needs, suggesting a more modest approach this time will still help stabilize household budgets.
You know, some low-income families, a smaller percentage, but some did use the child tax credit to either pay down debt or save a little. And that also is really significant, too, when we think about economic security for families.
She says that allowed households to be better prepared for unexpected expenses and stay afloat. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimates the new credit plan would lift 500,000 kids above the poverty line when fully phased in. In the first year, 41,000 South Dakota children would benefit. While the deal is bipartisan, it's unclear if other issues, such as avoiding a government shutdown, will stall debate. If the expanded credit is approved on a 3-year basis, Berg acknowledges it would give policy researchers more information about the best way to help struggling families. More importantly, she says it creates more predictability for those eligible.
When you think about like a new family who just had a baby, by the time this ends, that child's going to be three. 3 years of a young child's life is very significant when you think about maybe a family having, you know, the extra food they need.
The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says when the initial expansion expired, along with other pandemic relief, the number of children living in families below the poverty line increased by 5 million. Meanwhile, congressional leaders behind the plan hope to get it approved in time for this year's tax filing season, despite the other issues they're juggling. This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
The Greenland ice cap is losing an average of 33 million tons of ice an hour due to global warming, a new study has revealed. This is 20% more than was previously thought. Beside raising the sea level, some scientists are concerned that this additional source of fresh water into the North Atlantic could mean a collapse of the ocean currents called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. The collapse of AMOC in the connected Gulf Stream would bring more extreme winters to Western Europe, raise sea levels on the U.S. eastern seaboard, and disrupt vital tropical rains. A significant part of the Greenland ice sheet itself is also thought by scientists to be close to a tipping point of irreversible melting, which would bring ice equivalent to 4 to 7 feet of sea level rise. Math scores among elementary and high school students fell during the pandemic, but even before that, students often complained that math isn't fun. Experts are now debating what types of math should be required in high school and the best ways to improve math education. Roz Brown reports.
Of all the classes taught in school, many students say math is the hardest and their least favorite subject. But many jobs require math, and experts are evaluating recent survey results to determine what could help change the paradigm. Dr. Alicia Arriaga-Smith is with Just Equations, a nonprofit working to ensure educational equity. She says a recent survey found only 57% of students consider learning math important, and that's a challenge in a society that values science and technology.
One of the things that the findings point to is there are some creative ways where we could combine math with other subjects to show students how math can really come alive. Right now, we just don't do a really great job of doing that.
Of the 90,000 high school students surveyed, she says 70% said they believe in their ability to learn math through hard work, and 61% agreed they keep trying to solve a problem when the math gets hard. The survey was created and distributed by the national nonprofit Youth Truth. Director of Organizational Learning, Jennifer DeForest, says a student's relationship with their math teacher can make all the difference, because fewer than half of those surveyed said they were comfortable asking questions in their math class.
So those students would describe, for example, that their teachers set up classroom routines that required them to ask questions. And those teachers also created classrooms that recognized that learning, and even learning math, is a social process.
To change minds about the importance of math, Ariaga Smith says students at all levels need to understand that every current and future job requires some level of math.
Because so many things involve computers and data, you need math for so many things. Even if it's playing sports and figuring out the statistics and how you want to get better, math is really integrated into everything that we do.
For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows which way the wind blows.
Even the NFL bowed to the weather, as did Iowa voters, while Portland School District jumps at the first flake. Summer weather has just as much impact, but demands we come out and expose ourselves, not stay inside, blanket all the windows, inventory what food won't need cooking. Did the person who died when a falling tree crashed into their bedroom die in their sleep or wake at the last second? But the newspapers say nothing of those who died unhoused. The folks in D.C. pay as much attention to the weather as they do the price of gasoline or bread. At least enough of them realize what the blowback could be if the government shut down this year. They need re-election. And Donnie, if he could sue the wind for messing up his hair, you know he would, blaming Biden for the partisan weather. Losing electricity reminds me of how powerless I am and the not always hidden cost of what power I'm allowed. Harsh circumstances bring out the best in people, even when their own heat's not working. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 17th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Ray Bowell, Zoe Carina, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Lisa Loving, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Roz Brown,